I would say that there are some questions like, well, what makes me happy in the course of a given day and in the course of a given week? Where is my happy time? And if it's, I'm so stressed out, it's watching cat videos on social media, then maybe you should get a cat, right? You know, I think sometimes we assuage our stresses through distractions rather than passions and loves.
Welcome to Deviate with Rolf Potts. Today is my latest Vagabonding audio companion episode, where I dig deeper into the themes I explored in my books Vagabonding and The Vagabond's Way. In this episode, I remix a conversation I had with Chris Hutchins on his podcast All the Hacks, which is all about getting the best experiences in life without an expensive price tag. What I loved about this conversation was that Chris really dug into the concept of time wealth, which is something I always enjoy talking about, not just in the context of travel, but also in the context of family and work and day-to-day life. This episode was recorded back when I was promoting The Vagabond's Way, and we discuss a number of topics from that book, including the way, say, getting a haircut or going to a convenience store is a great way to experience a foreign city. We talk about how you experience travel in different ways as you get older and how going out for a simple walk can be more engaging than seeking bucket list attractions overseas. We talk about seeing neighborhood routines in tandem with your tourist routines on the road and the fine line between how technology can help or hinder the experience of a place. We talk about the joys of traveling with children and how to find global travel experiences in your own hometown. We start with the definition of time wealth. Let's listen in.
Thing. You talked about time wealth. Mm. So can we talk a little bit more about, you said it was this major unlock for you. How can people take that concept and improve their mindset and improve their travel?
Well, I think it's a core shift in what you consider wealth is. I think it's a matter of sort of letting what wealth you have serve you instead of shifting your existence to serve a certain idea of wealth. You know, I think oftentimes we go through all this trouble, you know, to reach certain goals, not realizing why we want them. And I think wealth is a big one, that there are certain metrics we use to judge wealth. And one is money, one is possessions, right? But I think the truest expression of wealth is being able to use this limited amount of time you have in your finite life. We're all born equally rich in time when you think about it, and finding ways to let that time enrich your life in a way that makes your dreams come true. I mean, I talk about travel all the time. So often I talk about time wealth in the context of travel. It could be about spending more time with your kids, for example. I meet travelers who go to the other side of the world and realize that very poor countries, you know, comparatively poor countries like Uganda or Cambodia, being a father in those places is much more interactive with their kids. They don't compartmentalize their fatherhood in those parts of the world like they do back home. So they learn almost by accident this idea of wealth as a manifestation of how you spend your time. And, you know, one interesting person I talked to is Kevin Kelly. I'm sure you're familiar with his work, a co-founder of Wired. He talks about how, you know, young people are richer in time than money and older people are richer in money than time. And I think one reason why young people are stereotypically more given to long-term travel is that they're in that situation. They don't have more money than older people. It's that they have less responsibilities. They have more of a willingness to forgo certain comforts to get more time out of what money they do have in their wallet. And so it really comes down to spending what money you do have in such a way that it makes your life more fulfilling. And I think oftentimes we think that travel is something that we buy rather than give to ourselves. And if we can figure out how to travel within that local economy, how to travel in a way similar to how people in the country we're visiting travel, then I'm sure that's how you were able to get 7.5 months, you know, for $7,500. It's not by the big flashy stuff that you see advertised in glossy magazines or even on Instagram feeds. It's the quieter, humbler, more interactive places where the people in West Africa or the people in Southeast Asia or wherever, South America, travel. And it pays off in time. You know, that chicken bus probably goes slower and has less air conditioning than the nice tourist bus, but it puts you into a culture in a way that the tourist bus doesn't, and it costs a lot less. It goes a lot slower and it pays off in that time wealth that we're talking about. Yeah, I could talk about time wealth all day. It's really, really worth thinking about in the context of we have a limited wealth of time in life and we should really take advantage of it, not put off our best self to another time of life. We should grab this time and let it enrich our lives.
One fun anecdote, which is my wife worked early at Lyft, and the origin story of the company was before it was Lyft, it was a company called Zimride. And before it was Zimride, The name hadn't existed, and one of the co-founders was in Africa riding one of those slow buses.
Yeah.
And that was the inspiration for starting Zimride, which became Lyft. So you say, you know, the luxury bus might have been more fancy, but in this particular random case, taking that one bus ended up building, you know, a multi-billion dollar company. So there is one anecdote of even that cheaper, slower, you know, maybe sweatier bus can pay off for some people. And I generally think travel is an opportunity to see people doing different things, different ways around the world. And that makes you a more creative person, makes you a more curious person, and leads to all kinds of things. So funny that you use the one example that I happen to know ended up becoming a wild success. But, you know, I think it's a fun story. I also think I had a conversation with my wife the other day, and we were talking about goals, and we haven't really gone through this process of like, what are our goals for our family, for our finances, for our health? But we thought, you know, we have two daughters now, maybe we should. And my wife had this, you know, financial goal. I want a net worth financial goal. And I pushed back to her, and this connects back to time wealth. But she said, you know, I would love to hit this milestone. And I said, okay, well, we could hit it, but would you be okay if that meant either one of us was working a lot more and not spending as much time together? And she's like, well, no, I wouldn't want that. And I was like, well, would you be okay if we moved to a different part of the country that was cheaper, or we cut back on some of the things we do? And she's like, well, no, I wouldn't want to sacrifice those things. And we had this conversation where in our minds, and this is purely, you know, part of the society we live in and the expectations we set on people, she had felt like we needed to like grow our net worth. And in a way, through this conversation about what we actually wanted to spend our time doing, we left being like, actually, maybe we need a smaller net worth. Like maybe we need less. Like Bill Perkins wrote this book, Die with Zero. And the premise is like, why are we trying to amass all this money? We should be trying to take the money we have and optimally use it to have the most fulfilling life. And in some cases, that might be actually not trying to grow and grow and grow your wealth, but maybe to find more creative ways to spend it or unlock time.
Yeah, no, I love this example. Actually, I love the shared taxi from Africa example too. But I think wealth is an abstraction. It's often future oriented. And one thing, using children as a great example, because oftentimes we think of children in terms of them being potential adults, when in fact, the blessing of having them as children is having them right where they are, right? And so, sure, it's good to create security and create good habits for your children, but part of the pleasure of being a parent is like having them being a newborn that is gripping their finger with their whole fist, right? And just being able to enjoy that moment regardless of what your net worth is in 20 years. I think one danger of having arbitrary goals for net worth is that you become focused on those goals rather than that very transient experience that is parenthood. You know, that each phase of your kid's life, it can be exhausting, of course, but it's also so special. You know, it's just so exciting. And then I think there's a different dynamic. I remember sort of when I shifted from being this kid that was being raised by my parents to this traveler who was sort of hosting his parents and sort of being the expert, and that they were the young, curious, naive people, even though they were my parents, in a place like China or the Czech Republic. And so I think, yeah, nothing against having goals or thinking about net worth or creating safety nets or steering children in such a way that they will become productive adults. But just that blessing, I think, you know, often that cliche is, you know, enjoy them while they're toddlers, that'll be gone. Enjoy them while they're infants, enjoy them while they're in grade school, because that you'll miss that. Well, you really do need to embrace that. And that sometimes if we're making decisions that are based on 20-year goals, rather than just looking at our kids or looking at our life or looking at our travel, looking where we are, then we are relegating our lives to an abstract future instead of embracing the beauty of the moment. You mentioned moving to another place. I'm based in Kansas, which is a much less fashionable place than the Bay Area where you're based. But one nice thing about that is that it just pays off. I'm not a parent, actually. I'm an uncle. I love being an uncle. But it costs less to get through the day to achieve certain goals in life, and that pays off in free time. And so I'm not saying that everybody needs to move to Kansas or to a cheap part of the world like Colombia, or, you know, there's a lot of places where digital nomads go because they can save money. But there are different tools, hacks, if you will, to take what money you do have, to take what income and interest that you have and loves, be it from family or activities, and find a way to make them a more active part of your life. I think that there's a lot of ways that you, if you can embrace the concept of time wealth and realize that there's different ways of freeing time up in your life, then you can really focus your life on that, on those present moment goals that make life richer and more enjoyable and more fun and more rewarding and more likely to give back to things like family and community.
Is there a process or a framework that someone listening to this is thinking, gosh, I really wish I could figure out what that means for me? Are there questions you would propose someone think about to kind of figure out what they want?
I would say that there are some questions like, well, what makes me happy in the course of a given day and in the course of a given week? Where is my happy time? And if it's, I'm so stressed out, it's watching cat videos on social media, then maybe you should get a cat, right? You know, I think sometimes we assuage our stresses through distractions rather than passions and loves. I think sometimes we don't know our passions. And I have nothing against college. My father taught college. My sister teaches college. And I think it's a very noble vocation. But sometimes we go to college without even knowing what we like to do. And other cultures have gap years. You know, in the UK, in Australia, they have places, like the gap year, where you take a year off after secondary schooling, but before university, where you travel or you work. And that allows you to find out what you really love to do and where your passions are before you spend all this money going to university. And so weirdly enough, I think that travel and maybe traveling for 7.5 months or whatever is a great way to find out what you love. I think there's what your parents think you should do. There's what your counselors think you should do. I think oftentimes young people, but even older people, it's the same way. That until you are off in another place, completely away from the pressures and routines and constrictions of living at home, you can really find out where your heart lies. You know, that you might sit in a village for a day and watch people build a house and think, gosh, I want to build my own house or study architecture or something like that. That's just a random example. But I think it's worth... One thing I talk about in the new book, in the context of a couple monks from hundreds of years ago, the young monk talks to the older monk. The older monk asks him a question about life, and he says, I don't know. And the older monk says, very good. Not knowing is most intimate. I think it's good to embrace not knowing yet, not just how to live our lives, but what our goals are, of just sort of being the person who's traveling through the world without not a lot of plans yet, but having the faith to think, eventually I'm going to really wander my way into something that makes my heart sing, that makes me fall in love with some aspect of life. And that's going to be focused on it. And that could be any number of things, including family. And so it's, I think, you know, for years I lived next door to my parents. My parents are now in assisted living. They're not far from me now. And the whole lesson of living next door to one's parents, which is not a very common American thing, is very common in almost every other part of the world, in Southeast Asia, in Africa, pooling your resources and getting land. And that paid off not just in the fact that I was able to save money, but I was able to spend some quality time with my parents at a really cool time in life. And so I think there's a lot of different strategies into creating, either on purpose or by accident. And this whole familial thing was an accident, it was an idea about how to live as a family that I didn't get till I was overseas. But there's ways to allow yourself to grow into ways of being that you might not seem now. You just need to allow yourself to sit still for a while and stop distracting yourself and start embracing things in life.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like spending a lot of time with family you picked up quite easily because it's so common in the rest of the world. Are there other major things that have affected the way you live your life now that are kind of themes that travel has brought you, aside from just traveling?
Right. Well, I travel is so much a part of things, but I think there are, if we can see as travel is more than a consumer act, there are certain commonalities that we see again and again. And it, you know, family is one of them. You know, people, you know, I've often said that when I was traveling through Southeast Asia, I was 27 years old. People would say, oh, are you married? Do you have kids? And I said, no, I don't. And they're like, oh, I'm sorry. Like it was such a core value in this part of the world. It's like, well, I got the sense from them that their happiness was so tied into family, into marriage and children and relationships with family, that it seemed weird that I, this very rich and comparatively rich and mobile guy, would not that have that as a core value. I think food, another one, to be very simple, like in France, that's not the only place where meals are much slower and more communal than we have in our standing up, you know, posting to Instagram while we're sipping our latte, first world society. And so I think it's really these basic building block things that travel has taught me to come home to. And even another great thing about France, but it's also something that you'll see in Africa or Asia, is eating food that was obviously grown within 20 miles of where you're eating it, you know, of biting into a cherry in France and feeling cheated because you didn't realize cherries could taste that good. And it's not some magical French thing. It's just that French place value on seasonal fruit produce. You know, they're not flying in cherries from Chile in the middle of the winter. There's a certain time in late June, early July when it's cherry season, and that's when you eat your cherries. And so weirdly enough, it's obviously travel has given me philosophical perspective with things like time wealth, but it's often these basic building block themes, love for family, concern about food, that I bring home and try to bake into my travel life. And then also just not rushing and multitasking things, being able to slow down and let a day happen instead of micromanaging and trying to rush through it to be somehow ahead of your competitive neighbor at the end of the day. I think that, not to fetishize other cultures, because I'm a big fan of American culture, but I think sometimes we are doing too much. We're throwing too much at life and not sitting still. And another great lesson I've had from travel is the ability to sit still and let a day happen in a way that really enriches it. And that can happen in a comparatively wealthy country like Norway, where I went for the first time this summer, or a comparatively poor country like Indonesia, where I went a few years ago. It's really fun to intertwine one's home life with lessons learned from travel. And I'm sure you discovered a lot of things on your own journey and the journeys you've had since.
Yeah, I mean, so many. I'd love to talk a little bit about how you have the kinds of experiences in a new place. Obviously, we mentioned, look, if you land in Paris and you go straight to a hotel and from your hotel to the Louvre and then from there to a reservation, you're going to kind of miss it. But are there things that you try to do in how you structure your time in a place, how long you're there, what you do first that kind of allow you to immerse yourself in a new place?
Well, one of the catchphrases from vagabonding that I refreshed in the new book, The Vagabond's Way, is walk until your day becomes interesting. And I think we often don't give ourselves credit for just showing up in a place and walking around without really knowing where we're going or having any goals or checklists, and just sort of walking until you sort of get a sense for the pace of a place. And instead of sightseeing, maybe smell seeing, follow the smells around a neighborhood and just find ways to slow down and realize that quotidian things are as amazing as sightseeing places. That, to use Paris as an example, they have a convenience store. It's an equivalent of 7-Eleven. It's called the Carrefour. There's also a Monoprix. And just realizing that it's a little bit different than the American equivalent. Another thing I write about in the new book is getting a haircut in Egypt on Zamalek Island in Cairo, which like took an hour and had 23 steps and cost $6, including tip. You know, just, I got one, it was the best haircut of my life, but it was just a haircut, right? You know, it also gave me perspective on the meticulousness of Arab masculinity as pertains to appearance. And so I had this wonderful experience just by willing myself to get a haircut in a foreign place. So I have nothing against sightseeing. I have nothing against tourist districts. I think it's pretty normal to go to places you've dreamed about. If you're in Egypt, sure, go to the pyramids. It'd be silly not to go to the pyramids, but get a haircut, you know, go to the local market, go to a sweet shop. A great thing about Egypt specifically is that they take their sweets very seriously. And just like way more than your average hostess ding dong, they have these handmade sweets that are amazing and dirt cheap and really fun to see. And so I'm sure I'm curious, like what strategies, you had a 7.5 months around the world. Did you have any go-to strategies when you landed in a place after you were a little bit salty as a traveler?
We tried to always, no matter what the trip was, what the purpose of the trip was, we try to always walk towards the food market or the market. It doesn't have to be a food market. It could be, you know, in Turkey, there are more, you know, markets in a lot of Arab cultures. It's just like everything's going on in the market. There's food stands, there's shopping. In some places, it's really more of a food market, and you know, you go early, right? And I think in Indonesia, like, the food market's closed by, you know, 10, 11 in the morning, because everyone's there right in the morning to get food. And that's a place where I think definitely you can smell, see, and you know, you can, all the senses are kind of a part of a food market. But it's also true, you know, in the fish market in Tokyo, it's like just people running around, bumping around, what's going on? I feel like that is my favorite place to kind of get my bearings of a city. It's like, what are people eating? What are they drinking? Are they negotiating? Are they a yelling culture? Are they a friendly culture? Like, you could see it all in this one place, and you could eat. Like, you know, you could do it on your own. Recently, I kind of love just going on a tour somewhere with some local of a food market and getting a lay of like, what do we eat in this culture? How do people shop? How do people buy? I don't know how you feel about, you know, hiring tour guides versus just walking solo. I think there's room for both for me, but that's where I start almost everything. And I mean, we went on our honeymoon to the Seychelles, but we still went to the food market, you know, the market that was, I think it was a fish market, you know, downtown, because we were like, we just want to feel a place. Even if the goal is to relax, like, we still want to feel the culture here.
Yeah, I love that. And I think sometimes travelers will go to a market and they'll walk through the whole thing, but they'll only go to the jewelry stand or the, you know, the brass figurine stand or whatever, like the obviously souvenir thing. But I love the idea of like getting ingredients for a meal, even if this vegetable, you don't even know what it is yet. You know, it helps to have a place with a kitchen, of course, but there's just so many times where tourists will spend like an hour in one of the most famous markets in the world, and then they'll go to a restaurant. It's like, no, buy food. Just get a picnic, get those figs and, you know, that tea or whatever, and have an adventure of it. And you mentioned a guide. Sometimes, like early in the travels, like in your first days in a place, I don't often get guides, but I'm not opposed to it, because sometimes the guides can help you negotiate things, and they can explain like, oh yeah, no, actually this isn't a fruit, it's a spice, and we use it in this soup for this reason. And it's really it gives you a head start. It's worth the monetary investment, because it gives you a head start on understanding how life works there. And I love market cultures. I also love market squares too, because oftentimes there's like a soccer game or people are playing foosball or basically it immediately insinuates yourself into the daily life of a place. Because again, Parisians aren't usually standing in line for the mosque. Egyptians aren't usually taking a tour bus to the Great Pyramids. They're doing different things. And both like Cairo and Paris, two of my favorite places in the world, really reward that walk through the market. And like in Paris, for example, different markets will be open on different days. In Cairo, like the best oranges I've ever had, I've gotten in a market in Cairo for pennies. You know, who would have guessed? But I was just wandering around and it's like, yeah, I'll get this orange that's half the size of my head. Why not? And it was delicious. And I think those are the surprises that you can't really, there's no app for that. You know, there's no micromanaged way to wander into those awesome market moments where suddenly you're eating this fruit that you didn't realize existed. And now you're on your fifth one, you know, because it's amazing, and you're in Indonesia, and it's a lot of fun. So yeah,
jackfruit for me. I had never heard of jackfruit my whole life. I tried it. Now I'm like, I love it. My daughter is two, and she's obsessed with jackfruit. So I'm like finding myself trying to find the Asian grocery store to go buy more jackfruit. And you know, I didn't even know it was a thing. I just saw it and I was like, what is this? They're like, well, it's kind of like a banana, maybe a pineapple, a little bit mixed, and it's my favorite.
Well, that's something you can take home too. You were talking before, just like, what attitudes do I take home? Well, sometimes it's the simplest one is food. Like, you know, for my birthday last year, my wife took me to a Korean restaurant way out in like probably an hour from here. Well, I was so excited because every time I eat Korean food, it reminds me of being back in Korea. In a way, I can always take a little bit of my heart back to Korea when I'm eating kimchi and bulgogi, right? And so that's a big part of it. It's almost like it's like suddenly these places are in conversation with each other. I'm curious, do you have any rituals that are sort of born of travel? Do you have any things at home that were sort of baked in by your journeys in other places?
Gosh, I'm trying to think through. I mean, I know when it comes to food, I'd say 50% of the foods that we cook are not, you know, traditional American foods. We cook a lot of Korean food because we love Korean food. You know, and so when we go to places, it's like, you know, the gifts I try to bring people, I'm like, oh, let's bring some smoked paprika from, is it Croatia has a lot? I can't remember what country, Budapest, Hungary. Hungary, I think, has a lot. I could be totally wrong here, but I think it was Hungary has a lot of paprika. So like I brought home everyone paprika, and the things we bring people are things to help them experience, you know, something kind of satiating, like the a drink, an alcohol, a spirit, a spice. I don't know. That's one. I remember I can't remember where I was that I experienced raclette, and we bought a raclette grill. My wife has since it's been this sore subject in our house, which is like, we never use this thing. And I'm like, no, but one day we will. And she's like, we've got to get rid of it. It hasn't been touched in 2 years. It's caked on with dust. But I think food is something that when we're in another country, it's like, I only want to eat local. In India, it was like, I will risk, you know, sickness to be able to eat the food on the street, drink the chai tea from the cups that the, you know, from, you know, a person on the, it's just, that's travel a lot for me, is kind of understanding that. And ideally talking to people about it. I think the experiences that have happened once we've come home are always being able to connect the dots in strange ways. So a great example was, we were in the park, just 5 minute walk from our house the other day, and all these people are dancing. And I was like, why is everybody dancing? This is not a park where there's normally dancing, but there's a bunch of kids and adults all dancing and eating. And I asked them, I said, well, what's going on? And they're like, oh, we're celebrating because it was the Lebanese festival last weekend and all these kids danced in a parade. And so now we're kind of celebrating here. And my daughter runs up to the middle of the group. A woman picks her up. And it's just, it's funny because I think many Americans would be terrified if a random person in a park starts picking up and dancing with your kid. But we were like, oh, you know, I've been to Lebanon and like the culture is just so welcoming. We ended up spending 2 hours there having meals, talking about our trip to Lebanon and having a way to connect with people. And I think, you know, it turns out we live half a mile from a Lebanese church, and they're like, come on every second and fourth Sunday is like when we have all the families there and we do all these events and gatherings. We don't care if you practice whatever religion, just come. We love meeting people who understand and are excited to learn more about our culture. And so I think one cool thing to take away, and depending where in the country you are, it could be harder or easier, but you don't have to go halfway around the world to have a really immersive cultural experience that's far different from where you are. And so I think we try to have those experiences when we're traveling, but we also try to have those experiences here and find the pockets of a city that, you know, are, you know, lots of Korean restaurants or lots of people doing XYZ, and try to do that while we're here, because, you know, for us, like, we can't always be traveling, and with two small kids, it's hard, but it's not hard to necessarily go to a local Korean restaurant or meet a bunch of Lebanese people dancing in the park.
That's awesome. And that's awesome. That's great that you had a kid that was just completely fearless and just ran in and sort of insinuated in that situation. Kids are actually a great travel tool. I have a lot of old traveler friends who, you know, they get married and they start to have kids and they're worried that it's going to cut into their travel experience. You know what, I can, because kids need a certain structure and discipline on the road. But I found that people around the world love kids and they don't really need a common language to pick up a kid and admire how cute it is. And so kids can really be in a window into a place. And when they get to a certain age, not only are they fearless, but they have no preconceptions about what is or isn't important. I have a chapter in The Vagabond's Way about, I went with my nephew to Père Lachaise Cemetery in France, and he was 14. And usually you go there and it's like, oh, here's Jim Morrison's grave, or here's Oscar Wilde's grave, or here's Abelard and Eloise. Well, he was 14. He didn't know who any of these people were. He, you know, Jim Morrison died the year I was born, so he barely knew who the Doors were. But he just was curious about everything. He's like, well, why are there all these flowers on this grave? You know, his name is Frank Alamo. It's like, well, I don't know. And he's like, you don't know who Frank Alamo is? It's like, I've been here for 10 times, but I don't know. So we looked it up, and Frank Alamo is like this sort of Elvis style pop star who just died in France. And there's this other grave in the cemetery that had all these hammers and weasels carved into this giant grave. And it was this Russian princess who her fortune was made on iron and fur, hence the hammers and the weasels. And it's just sort of this strange mystery that basically all he brought to this place was his imagination, because he was a 14-year-old kid. And suddenly I was learning things that in a cemetery that I'd been to several times. And so I think kids can be a great travel tool, because not only are they just excited that people are dancing, but also they humanize you to other people. You know, that it's one thing to be a couple of outsiders in a group, but outsiders with kids who are excited about things, then suddenly you're one of them in a certain way. That a family is a very recognizable unit around the world. And it's a great window into places.
I know you don't have children, but you've got your nephew. I'm sure you've had, you know, more travel conversations than probably anyone listening. Are there tips that you've picked up from others that you'd give to people with kids trying to think, gosh, you know, travel can be stressful with children. It seems like too much. How to make it easier, how to make it feel more approachable?
Well, again, structure is something that they need more than your average dirtbag traveler. You know, they need, sort of need a sense for how each day works. But maybe also take them into environments that that do capture their imagination, maybe environments where there are other kids. You know, we default to sort of a museums and cathedrals way of travel, which is fine and interesting, but it's sort of more abstracted. It's more tied into things like history or religion or wherever. We're sometimes just a random park. Like now I feel like if somebody's in the Bay Area, they should go to this park where you found that dance. You know, like basically any park where people are having fun is a window into a place. And kids, at the end of the day, love to run around. And there's so many places, you know, preferably away from heavy traffic, where kids can run around and suddenly you're hanging out and your kids are opening doors into a place that you wouldn't have noticed before, because kids don't need to have a common language to run around and have fun. And sometimes they'll talk to each other and have perfect conversations without realizing they don't really speak the same language at a certain age. And so I think just sort of that openness and realizing that it's a lot simpler than you think. I think we can sometimes micromanage parenthood in the United States. You know, we have our special backpack full of the sippy cup and then the iPad and all these things that we feel like we need to keep a kid occupied, when in fact a green space where they can run around with other kids is great, you know. Or actually that market, I'm sure kids would be really excited visually and sensually by a market, just because it's like, to use a metaphor that would make sense when I was a kid, it's like something from Star Wars, you know. It's like the cantina scene from Star Wars where the music is different and the food is different. And in this kid-like way, it's like you're on another planet. And so I think allowing your kids to engage their imaginations in a way that we as parents and elders sometimes have ceased to do is a great way to make them great travel allies and to sort of follow their example of being kid-like in a place that we don't understand, but we can be engaged by.
I want to talk a little bit about slow travel, but I think that is also a big thing. I haven't done this yet. Our kids are 2 and 4 months, but we thought about travel. It's like, what if instead of trying to take a week trip to Italy, we take a month trip, we find some Airbnb, we could rent our place out here while we're gone so that the cost of the trip is a little cheaper. Or maybe, you know, I haven't thought about this. Maybe we find a family and stay with them or something and get to know people. But when you're there and you create a routine, you can create the routine there. There's not as much pressure of, oh, well, we have to do all this stuff because we're only here for 4 days. It's like, well, today we're going to go to the park. Maybe we're going to sit at a cafe. We'll come home. You can take a nap. Like, we don't have to get it all done. And I think I'm really excited to do a little bit more of that style travel, which we did on our big trip because we didn't have the money. So we were just like, we're going to stay in this city for a week because we can't afford to keep moving. I think that could be something valuable to do with kids instead of the kind of traditional late 20s kind of trip where you're just like, go, go, go through everything.
I think that's great. Like, experience more by doing less, you know? And in fact, you live in a very popular part of the United States. There's actually home exchanges. You can find somebody in Italy who wants to live in the Bay Area for a while. There are online sites where you can do home exchanges. I live in Kansas.
Have you heard of people that have had success? I want to do a little bit of research here, but it's like, what are the odds that there's a person in Italy who wants to come to the Bay Area the same week I want to go to Italy? Like, have you heard good success stories from people doing this?
Absolutely. Some of the students in my Paris class from the Bay Area have done home swaps. Okay. So they basically find a place to stay during my class in Paris while the French family is enjoying a California vacation of their own. It's there's no silver bullet. It's not a perfect thing, but it's very doable, especially if you live in a part of the United States where people from other countries would like to live in themselves. And then the great thing about being with a family in a place is that doing chores, washing dishes, you know, you're basically routine. You're suddenly doing it in a more Italian way. And I guarantee you, when you walk down the same street for the third day in a row with your super cute kids, the guy that owns the pastry shop is going to come out with a little snack for your kids, just so that, you know, basically you become a part of the habit of that neighborhood. I think sometimes tourists, even backpackers, are ghosts. They're there for a couple of days and they're gone. And so you can't really develop relationships. Whereas in for a month, it can be really special if there's this American family that suddenly in the village and they don't speak the language that well. And they're sort of cute when they order the food because they get the words wrong, and they, you know, they order a dessert food item for dinner or whatever. But then suddenly you have this new enlivened empathy simply because you have joined, instead of being part of a touristic routine in a place, you've joined the daily routine of the people who live there. And then suddenly you and your family, or you and your partner, or you as a person alone are experiencing a place in a very rich way that is not ticking five countries off your list, but it's taking one community for example, a month. And you're really going deep in a way that you're probably more likely to think about it in your old age, that 1 month in the beautiful Italian village, than if you'd been racing to five different countries in that 1 month during the same time. So I'm a big fan of slow travel.
It's funny because you talked earlier about getting your hair cut, and I think back to our trip around the world and some of the most memorable moments. And mine too was getting my hair cut in Nairobi by someone who was terrified because of, like, I've never cut a white person's hair in my whole life. And I was like, look, I promise you, you can't mess this up. Like, I don't care. And we had this amazing, like, it wasn't quite as long as your experience, but it was so much fun and we had a great conversation. And I remember that infinitely more than probably, I mean, I can't even tell you the restaurant that maybe someone recommended I go to or was the highest rated and we went to. I don't know what it was. I don't remember a dinner out in Nairobi, but I do remember that haircut. And so I think that's interesting. You mentioned checking items off a list. I'm curious how you feel about people creating bucket lists or kind of, is that something that you're like anti-bucket list? You like it? How do you feel about the concept?
Well, I have a whole mini chapter about bucket lists. I'm not anti-bucket list, but you really have to understand that the bucket list is what gets you out the door, because so many items on the bucket list, the pyramids being a great example. Well, there's a lot of tourist buses there. There's a lot of Egyptians there who are part of the tourist industry, and they want you to pay $100 to sit on a camel, which is fine. But I think, you know, 5 hours spent in a neighborhood market in Cairo is going to be more rewardingly Egyptian than you would have 5 hours waiting in line and going around and getting your pictures for Instagram at the pyramids. I'm not going to say don't go to the pyramids, but I'm just going to say that the things that you find by accident on the way to the various items on your bucket list are probably going to be the things that make you happiest. You're talking, and not to make this all about haircuts, but I was driving in New Orleans with my friend Dan once, and he just said, I'm sick of my hair. I need a haircut. So we just pulled off the road. We just happened to be in Canton, Mississippi. We pulled into a place. It was a black neighborhood, and we go into a barbershop, and the guy's like, I've never cut white hair, but I got this. This is the United States. And we sort of made the day of everybody in this black barbershop. Like, it was sort of this collective effort, like, let's cut Dan's hair. He doesn't have, you know, the naturally kinky black hair that the people in this neighborhood have, but let's figure this out, because in Canton, Mississippi, white people never come into this barbershop. And so it was this funny thing. It wasn't the best haircut that my friend Dan ever got, but we sort of made their day, because in a town where, you know, there's still elements of segregation and white people just don't swagger into the barbershop in the black part of town. Suddenly we had this experience that, you know, whatever lack of proficiency that in the haircut was, it was super memorable and super fun, where suddenly we were just sort of casually hanging out in a black barbershop in Canton, Mississippi, because we needed a haircut. And it was as memorable as anything we found on the way to New Orleans, right? So we had a blast in New Orleans. I'm not going to knock that. But part of what was fun were the things that happened away from Bourbon Street, or the other things that you're supposed to see in New Orleans, or on the way to New Orleans itself, stopping in this town that we didn't really know much about before we randomly walked into a barbershop to get a haircut. So I think being willing, even as you seek out items on your bucket list, to surprise yourself and to sort of foolishly wander into a barbershop that isn't necessarily used to cutting your kind of hair, that can be super memorable. It was obviously memorable for you in Kenya, and it was memorable for us in Mississippi.
I mean, I think this juxtaposes something really fascinating, which is, you know, I think, oh, I had this experience. I had to go halfway around the world to get my hair cut by someone who'd never cut a white person's hair. And here you do it straight in the United States. And I think so much of travel, and I'm guilty of this myself. It's like, in order to have these crazy experiences or unique experiences or different experiences, you have to go halfway around the world. Can you help me get over that? Like, this was one example, but how do you feel about the fact that I feel like there's all this pressure to have to travel? You need to hop on a plane and cross an ocean.
Yeah, well, a couple of things came to mind. One is that whole concept of walk until your day becomes interesting. You can, like, just going for walks, counterintuitive walks in your own neighborhood or in one neighborhood over, and just sort of even walking to work or driving to work in a way that you're not used to doing, just sort of finding different patterns in your home environment on foot can be really interesting. One thing I talk about in the Vagabond's Way is how about during the pandemic, my wife and I were itchy to travel, but we really couldn't. So we decided we couldn't go see your cousins in Norway. So we decided to walk to a town in Kansas called Little Sweden. It was 22 miles from our front door to Little Sweden. It took us 7 hours. Our feet hurt really bad, but it was so fun to see this little landscape of the Kansas countryside on foot through a method that we had never seen before. So that was really fun. Even simpler than walking 22 miles to Little Sweden is these food experiences. And I think one fun thing about the barbershop experience in Mississippi is that we had broken an unwritten rule, which is white people don't get their hair cut in black neighborhoods, right? Well, oftentimes we go to places that are, air quotes, dangerous in our own hometown. But even places where poorer people live, they have to eat lunch. What's it like to go to a cafeteria counter in a neighborhood we don't usually go to? And so I think sometimes we realize that there's a wealth of cultural options in our own town just because we're sort of in the habit of our own social class or our own bubble of familiarity in our home. And that sometimes a neighborhood that's sort of seen as a barrio neighborhood probably has the best Mexican and Latin American food in your own community. And the reason, and it might not have a nice, it might just be a storefront that's next to a television repair shop, but odds are that food is really great. And the price of doing it is just being willing to go to that part of town where maybe not as many people speak English as they do in your own neighborhood and going to a place where people who might have a generation ahead of them still living in Mexico, and suddenly you're eating food in a context. And actually, speaking of Mexico specifically, my sister who teaches college in the Little Sweden town here in Kansas, she realized that most of the Mexican people who worked at local restaurants and stuff didn't just come from Mexico, but they came from Zacatecas. They came from a place called Fresnillo. And she realized that there were buses that go from central Kansas to Zacatecas. Like for 10 or 20 bucks, you can go to Mexico on the same buses that migrant workers go to see their family, right? And so just by asking, just like pushing the envelope, by not just going to the Mexican restaurant, by saying, where exactly in Mexico are you? How often do you see your family? Really, there's a shuttle service that goes to Wichita that takes you to a bigger bus that goes to Dallas, that takes you to an even bigger bus that takes you to the border, and then you take Mexican buses home. She actually was able to create an adventure to Mexico with her family that cost nothing. And they were able to, instead of hanging out with tourists going to Mexico, to Cancun, nothing against Cancun, but basically they took a bus full of people who work in the service economy of central Kansas, and they were able to get to see a part of Mexico that they never would have otherwise seen because they were willing to see a part of Kansas that they had never otherwise seen. So I think food in immigrant communities is a huge window. Even if you don't end up on a minibus to Mexico, being willing to just unfold the layers in an immigrant community in your own hometown is a great way to experience travel while you're still home.
So there are a few things we haven't touched on that I'd love to talk about briefly. I know you took this trip about, I don't know, a decade ago where you just literally had no bags. So first off, that's wild. You know, we did no checked bags, which I think is doable. TBD on how doable it is with small kids. But what did you learn from going on a trip with no bags? And what does that change now? What do you not take on trips now?
Well, one thing I learned almost immediately that this big central core conflict in telling a story about traveling the world with no luggage became pretty easy, pretty fast. I was traveling with a sponsor. I had a vest full of things where I could put things in my pockets, and I got used to that system very early. And people would often say, "Well, gosh, I wouldn't want to sit next to you on an airplane. You must smell bad." And it's like, no, I actually showered every day and I washed my clothes every day. I had, you know, basically at the end of the day, I would take off the clothes I was wearing, shower with them, dry them up for the next day. And I would just rotate two sets of clothes. So I was actually very clean. And once I got used to it, it was pretty simple to do. And, you know, early on, my sponsors are saying, well, should we contact the Guinness Book of World Records? I don't think this has ever been done. And it's like, have you heard of refugees? You know, have you heard of merchants that have been traveling the world forever? You know, like the idea that you have to travel the world with a bunch of giant bags is pretty new in a certain sense. And so, I guess the first lesson I learned is that once I sort of got into my meticulous cleanliness routines, I didn't really miss my bags that much. Now, this has not made me a full-time no baggage traveler but what it did make me realize is that it's not that hard to take a small day pack or like 30 liter or less backpack with you that you can put in the overhead bin, because at the end of the day, it really what I was most relieved not to have were the giant bags that I had to check under the plane or drag around over the cobblestones or to grunt through the tropical country with sweat dripping down my brow. I realized that my kit, whether it be in pockets or in a relatively small bag, you don't really need that much to have a great time when you travel. And in a sense, our best travel memories aren't about the crap that we put in our backpack. You know, it's about this awesome thing that we found in the village square. It's about these people we met, or it's this experience we had, or at the very least, it's about something that we got and we put in our backpack and brought home from the other side of the world to commemorate this memory of a great experience we had before. So it was such an instructive trip. And to this day, I haven't really done anything that compares to going literally with no baggage for 6 weeks around the world. It was a blast to do, but it's really leavened me. Like 3 years ago, I traveled around the world for 3 months with one 30-liter bag, and it was easy. And in fact, I still felt like sometimes I was overpacked. At the end of the day, it just didn't take that much for me to have a great time and have everything I needed. And one final thought about that, it's even easier these days with so much on your smartphone to help guide your trip, from GPS maps to language translators. There's fewer things that you do have to pack in your bags. Of course, this brings up the can of worms of your phone can actually distract from your travel experience too. But there's really no longer any reason to take a bunch of stuff around the world. Just discipline yourself into taking the bare minimum and letting the world provide the rest, including experiences.
Yeah. Are there any items that you're like, this one particular brand of shoes or sweater is like the thing that I always bring now? Is there anything for you that's like your go-to travel item?
I think, you know, besides my Kindle, you know, and I don't want to sing the praises of Kindle too much because I'm a big fan of independent bookstores, and my new book is out in hardcover. It's my fifth book, but it's the first time I have a book in hardcover. But like the Kindle allows me to take my library with me. I love it. There's certain clothing items. I'm a fan of merino wool, for example. I'm a fan of my 30-liter pack. I'm a fan of Blundstone boots. They're not a sponsor. Actually, my merino wool and my pack are sponsors because Vagabonding is such an old book. People have actually started travel product companies and said, look, Vagabonding inspired this. So it's like, oh, y'all wear it. This is pretty good. Blundstone Boots out of Australia is not one of those companies. I think they've been making them since the 19th century. I love Blundstones. They don't have laces. You can slip them on and slip them off. They're very sturdy. They look good. They look as good in a nightclub as they do on a mountain trail. And so I'm a big fan of that. But it's not that many things. It's my Kindle, my boots, a few toiletries, my merino wool, and I'm a pretty minimalist traveler, and I'm happy traveling that way.
Well, you brought up the phone, so I feel like it'd be a good place to go. I thought about the first international trip I took that I remember. I took some as a young kid, but the first one that I was like on my own without my parents. And I went to Taiwan when I was the first freshman or sophomore in college. Because I'd gone to boarding school. My roommate in high school was in Taiwan. I was like, I want to go visit him. And I was like, gosh, we didn't have iPhones. Like, you know, so I was like thinking about this trip and all the things we did. And I was like, well, I guess we just relied on, you know, locals and instincts and just, it didn't matter. Now I think about trips and the way technology's changed both for the better and the worse, the experience of being somewhere. I know you've challenged people to leave their phones behind at different parts of trips. How do you think technology has changed things and how can we still have the kinds of experiences that we all want to have and not get distracted?
Well, I remember that first wave of technology that really allowed us to travel in a different way. And in fact, my example is my first vagabonding trip was 1994. I was living in a van and I would call my parents once a week with my calling card. This is before I used email. 5 years later, I was living in Asia. And it felt like a luxury to be able to email my family. I was in closer touch with my family from Mongolia than I was from Oklahoma, right? Just 5 years earlier. Around that same time, that was 1999, I remember there were some articles, I think in the San Francisco Chronicle, about how virtual reality will allow you to travel the world without leaving your home, right? Well, now that we have the smartphone, now that we have this little black mirror in our pockets, we can be traveling the world without really leaving home in the habit sense, you know? We're still sending text messages to our friends. We're still looking at our social media feeds. We're still reading, instead of picking up the local newspaper, we're reading an online newspaper or an online social media feed that we still do back home. In a sense, smartphones have made travel easier. They've made it harder to get lost and harder to get bored, but they've also sort of trapped us into those same insipid habits that we have back home. And I've literally met travelers who even on the other side of the world, the last thing they do before they fall asleep is look at their phone. The first thing they look at when they wake up is look at their phone. It's like, guys, you've paid all this money to go to the other side of the world. Do you really need to put a phone between yourself and what you're experiencing? And so that's why I'm a big fan of encouraging people to use their five senses, to not just look and listen, but to smell and taste and feel their way around the world. And really, you don't have to travel without a phone at all, but maybe leave it in the room for a day and just... And my wife and I did this in Paris and Norway this summer. We found all the cool places we wanted to see on our computers and phone when we were still in our lodging, but we would mark it on a paper map and use that paper map to explore the city. And that allowed us to not fall back on our phone every time we thought we were lost, not to fall back on our phone every time we wanted to send that cool picture of the cool dog to our mom back home, right? Basically, it just forced us to be unconnected for a while. And we could have those experiences. And sometimes there's this little pencil for a restaurant that we wanted to see in the 20th arrondissement, but suddenly we found a place in the 11th arrondissement that was sort of cooler and completely caught us by surprise. And this cool fromagerie was next door and we got some cheese for the next day, right? So I think allowing yourself to have experiences by chance, to use the information that is available through our phone, but not to drown ourselves in all these options so that we're always questioning the moment we're in. I think, again, going back to the idea of living so much of our lives in the future, even as we plan and try to be responsible individuals, we cheat ourselves so much out of what is in the present. And there's that old, it's actually an old phrase now, FOMO, fear of missing out. Sometimes if we have our phone, we can be having this amazing experience in an amazing city, but our phone is telling us that, oh, maybe there's a better market like that's 5 minutes this way, or maybe there's a better restaurant that's 10 minutes this way. Actually, no, it's amazing. You found this place by accident. Embrace that while you have it. Give yourself permission to trust your instincts, to trust your nose and your palate as much as that smartphone app, because those are the things that you're going to remember, that you're really allowing yourself to travel as a pilgrim instead of as a consumer, and to sort of wander yourself into a deeper understanding of what that travel experience can be.
So a couple of things I want to hit before we wrap. You know, I found that one of the greatest ways that I lighten the cost of my travels is to play the travel hacking points and miles game. I know you're not as deep in that world as me, but I'm curious if there are any kind of cost saving travel hacks that you like that we can share with people listening.
My old one was just fly into a place and then take it from there. You know, that regardless of the multi-itinerary you could do, there might be a train that crosses an international border. There might be buses. There might be share taxis that could inspire the next Lyft or Uber in some part of the world that you didn't even know existed, but suddenly it's a really cool way to travel. And the people are just delighted that this awkward, sweaty American is in this share taxi in Laos or Senegal or some other part of the world. So I'm a big fan of overland travel and flying into a place and winging it from there. Oftentimes, too, you go into the neighborhood in Bangkok or the neighborhood in Nairobi where local people find their plane tickets. And oftentimes those onward flights are cheaper than if they had been done internationally through a middleman. What I've done as I've gotten older, I'm not the best flight travel hacker in the world. I could probably learn from you and other people who've done that quite well with credit cards and miles and things like that. In part, I got so insinuated in the overland travel into the point-to-point, sort of bucket shop travel. Bucket shops are places where in immigrant communities or in local communities where you buy discounted tickets. But I've often found that more recently I've taken a lot of trips through flight aggregators like Airtrex.com, that allows you to plan multi-stop itineraries under one umbrella that you can fly around. I think they do itineraries up to 25 stops. But I usually do it like 4 to 8 stops. I've done it around the world, but this summer, for example, I went from Denver to London, to Paris, to Norway, to Faroe Islands, back to London and Denver. And just under one umbrella, I was able to sort of have them put together the best flights possible. There's two ways you can do it with Airtrex. One is that they have sort of an online widget that you can go in and sort of, one fun thing is you can waste half a day just sort of doing a sample trip that you don't actually plan on taking, but just seeing how much would it cost for me to fly from New York to Brazil, to West Africa, to Italy, and take a train to Moscow, and then take another train to the Pacific, and then fly to Bangkok. Like, you can waste a day just doing trips that are absurd and just to see if it works. They also have a number that you can call and talk to a person. I usually use them in tandem, and the person will help you put together this trip And they might give you some advice like saying, well, actually the cheapest way to fly from Los Angeles to Australia is through Singapore. And maybe you can just stay for a week in Singapore on this cheap trip and get another experience out of that trip. So what I do with AirTrex is usually I'll tinker around with their online widget. And then when I think I sort of think I know where to go, I'll call the representative. It's sort of like a travel coach, and they help you design that flight. And so I'm not saying it's always the best way to hack flights, but my gosh, if you have an extended multi-stop or around the world flight, it's a great way to go because it saves money. And then you basically have everything is under one bucket. And you basically have an advisor that can give you that great advice saying that, like, yeah, you'll save $200 going through Bangkok. And actually Bangkok's pretty cool. Why don't you stay there 2 weeks and save another $100? So that's, it's not technically a hack, but it's a great service. AirTrex.com.
Cool. And then the last other question I always like to ask everyone, you know, is there a city in the world you know well enough to leave anyone listening who might be heading there with a few kind of unusual or fun recommendations for whether it's a meal, a drink, or some unusual activity or experience?
Wow, let me think. You know, immediately it came to mind, Paris. It's like, I'm not even that much of an expert on Paris. I've been there many, many, many summers in a row to teach English. And so my French isn't even that good. I'm there teaching classes in English. And the Parisian, this is sort of cheating on the answer, but it's a good answer. It's an old French technique of the flâneur. Do you know what a flâneur is? A flâneur is, this is Baudelaire sort of invented the idea in the 19th century. It's a person who walks through the city, not in search of things, but just in search of experiences. They don't see the city as this utilitarian route between point A and point B. It's a person that realizes that wandering from point A to point B is full of experiences that you don't know about yet. And so you can use it as, it's technically it's a male verb, but you can be a flâneuse or you can be a female flâneur. But it's a noun, but it can also be a verb. I'm going to flâneur my way through this experience. It's very baked into the Parisian way of seeing the world. You can practice it in any city in the world. And, you know, you probably don't want to go through a dangerous neighborhood drunk at night, but being a flâneur who just sort of wanders through a city, not quite knowing where you're going to go, but knowing that something awesome is going to happen. Again, you know, based on something you smell, something you see, or somebody you bump into, that is a great strategy for seeing a place. And I'll have an aside story. I talk about it in the Vagabond's Way that I use TripAdvisor to find TripAdvisor's best rated Rendang restaurant in the Indonesian city of Bukittinggi. I went there and it was fine. But what I realized, I'd gone through a market, again, going back to markets, through of people who lived in Bukittinggi eating dinner. And they weren't going to this place. They didn't use TripAdvisor. They lived in Bukittinggi. They're eating in the market. And so I realized that I had used this, instead of just flâneuring my way through the market and seeing what was delicious, I'd used TripAdvisor to go to a place that was outside of the market. So that has only reinforced the idea that wandering through a place, just sort of being hyper aware, not to your phone, but to the environment in the manner of a flâneur who's just seeking experience and is seeking surprise, that's probably better than any single recommendation I could give you in Paris.
This has been Deviate with Rolf Potts. More about everything that was just mentioned, including information about Chris Hutchins and his All the Hacks podcast, can be found in the show notes at rolfpotts.com/deviate. And as always, you can contact me with insights or questions at deviate@rolfpotts.com. This episode was produced by Cedar Van Tassel, who also does the theme music. Thanks for listening, and I hope you turn in for future episodes of Deviate with Rolf Potts.